find me on Twitter, twitter.com/JasonRants. Lots of news happening all around the world and right here at home as we wait for the president to speak on the coronavirus. Until then, let's find out what's trending.
What's trending at home?
So the second court of appeals, Circuit Court of Appeals, overturned a lower court ruling that sided with states, including Washington, that complained that when the administration decided to withhold millions and millions of dollars towards law enforcement grants after the sanctuary states refused to cooperate with ICE, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals said, you know what? Trump administration gets to do this. This all stems from a moment back in 2017, an announcement that the Trump team had put out there that said, look, we don't like that you're refusing to cooperate with ICE. We don't like that you're refusing to grant ICE the ability to go into a jail to go after a criminal illegal immigrant. We don't like that you are releasing criminal illegal immigrants, meaning they're in this country illegally, but that's not the problem. The problem is, while in this country illegally, they're committing violent acts. They're committing crimes. And you're just releasing them without actually letting us know, not listening to our detainer request. You're not doing that for us, so you know what? We're not going to give you any money. We're not going to grant you the money that you're putting into some law enforcement agencies around the country. A group of states that have sanctuary status policies, they decided, you know what? We're going to challenge this in court. You have no right to put conditions on the money that you're giving us. Now, of course, that seemed kind of weird, that the argument is that the federal government has to give you grant money regardless of whether or not you listen to the conditions that they put on that money. Seemed kind of weird, but frankly, three lower courts sided with states like Washington, New York. I believe California was on that list. But now it goes to the Circuit Court of Appeals in Manhattan, and they say, whoa, 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 slow your roll. Actually, the federal government does get to put conditions on the amount of money that they're giving you. The Attorney General of the United States gets to do that. And yes, they maintain pretty broad power over states on immigration issues. Why is that important? Well, we've got something called the Supremacy Clause, which grants the federal government that kind of power over the states. It's why, in a lot of instances, ICE doesn't really have to follow the sanctuary city laws. We've got one being discussed right now in Washington state that would ban ICE agents from moving forward and arresting someone at a courthouse, but not just at a courthouse, but within a mile of a courthouse. That, of course, is not legal. They can pass it all they want in Washington state. It's not legal. It's not going to be withheld in courts. And it doesn't matter because ICE can go ahead and do it anyway. If they've got the reason to arrest someone who's in this country illegally for committing a crime on top of being in this country illegally, they get to do it. There is this bizarre protection in the United States, in sanctuary states and sanctuary cities, that doesn't quite make sense. I totally understand why someone, some politician, might put in a policy to protect people who are in this country illegally, who beyond that aren't actually breaking laws. I actually support that. I don't believe in just going ahead and deporting 12 million people. I don't believe in that. I understand why people are coming here illegally. I want to put more resources at the border because I don't want it to be incentive that we're not deporting people for others to come into this country illegally. But if we're talking about Dreamers, for example, who are going to school, getting an education, they're working in their community, they were brought here as a child, they don't know any other language, let alone another country, I don't believe in deporting them. However, if you're in this country illegally and you are committing criminal acts, you do not deserve compassion nor protection. And yet somehow, some reason, Washington State and other sanctuary states and cities decide to treat both of those groups of people exactly the same. They should not be treated the same. I support protecting people who want to be in this country and respect our laws. I do not have that same respect for people who are flouting our laws. I don't feel the need to protect someone who two times assaulted and raped a woman in White Center in a wheelchair. I want that person deported. I don't think that's a controversial position. I don't want the dreamer deported. I want the rapist deported. But in Washington state, they treat the rapist and the dreamer exactly the same. And it's very similar to the HIV bill that we've been talking about. I was on Tucker Carlson last night. We're going to play that clip later on in the day. Producer Peyton, did I tell you that I was on Tucker Carlson last night?
You went on national TV.
Millions of people saw me. I'm surprised that I didn't promote that because usually I make a note to at least mention it one time. But yes, I was on Tucker Carlson last night. And we talked about this HIV bill in Washington State in which they are not making any difference between someone who's living with HIV and someone who is purposefully giving HIV to another person. They see no difference between the victim and the person who's doing the victimizing. It is a position that, frankly, does not make any sense. But that's the law that they're trying to push. And this is the reality that they're trying to push. So I'm glad that this loss in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, it's not over. It's being appealed. I'm assuming it's going to make its way up to the Supreme Court. It might be a long ways away from that because all that this ruling does is send it back to the lower court. So we'll see what the lower courts decide to do based on the guidance coming from the appeals court. But we'll find out. Certainly hopeful. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? Let's get political.
So last night there was another debate, the final debate ahead of both the South Carolina primary on Saturday and Super Tuesday of next week, where we're going to get a better sense as to where the DNC wants the candidates to go. Because I'm expecting Amy Klobuchar is going to drop out after Super Tuesday. There's going to be renewed calls for Pete Buttigieg to drop out. And depending on what happens on Saturday, you're going to see movement towards supporting, again, the Joe Biden candidacy, or again, sort of leaning away from him and going into Michael Bloomberg. Joe Biden has to have at least a 10-point lead over Bernie Sanders in South Carolina. And the polling seems to suggest that things are tightening. And because Bernie Sanders has all the momentum on his side, he's considered the front runner for the Democratic Party. And because he's not even a Democrat, but a socialist who's in that position. Last night, you saw pretty much everybody gang up on Bernie Sanders. It started with Amy Klobuchar, who went after Senator Sanders for his Medicare for All plan and the fact that he has no idea how much it costs.
No, the math does not add up. In fact, just on 60 Minutes this weekend, he said he wasn't going to rattle through the nickels and the dimes. Well, let me tell you how many nickels and dimes we're talking about. Nearly $60 trillion. Do you know how much that is for all of his programs?
That is three times the American economy.
Not the federal government, the entire American economy. The Medicare for All plan alone, page 8 clearly says that it'll kick 149 million Americans off their current health insurance in 4 years. That is true.
So Bernie Sanders then comes back and says, actually, even though during the 60 Minutes interview I didn't want to talk about the nickels and dimes that go into the actual plan, I now have a cost associated with it.
What the Health and Human Services have said in analyzing health care costs, what recent Yale study has said is that your program would cost some $50 trillion over a 10-year period. We would continue to pay, in some cases, 10 times more for the same exact prescription drugs. What every study out there, conservative or progressive, says, Medicare for All will save money. Ours will cost about $45 billion, not $60 trillion.
Okay, so when you go from $45 billion to $60 trillion, that's a lot of zeros in between. He's 100% incorrect. He is citing one study that gives the rosiest of rosy projections as to the cost of his plan. And it just so turns out, this Yale study that he referred to there, its lead author is also an advisor to the senator's Senate office, okay? Not his campaign, but his Senate office. The lead study that happens to say exactly the best talking point to push against critics who argue his is too expensive. His advisor wrote that study. And when you actually look at that study and you compare it to the other ones out there, the Yale study is the outlier. Now, I suppose it's certainly possible that of all the studies that looked into this, Yale, who is, in this case, the lead author working for Bernie Sanders, that one happens to be right. You can make that argument. Or you can look at literally all of the other ones. You can still like the plan if you like the plan. But let's stop pretending that the Yale study somehow is the end-all, be-all when there's a very clear conflict of interest. And when you look at the actual study, you start to see the way that they come up with those numbers. They make a lot of assumptions. They assume that the $219 billion that would be saved under Sanders' plan would come from administrative savings. Because when you look at the Medicare program, they currently say it spends 2.2% on overhead. When you look at private insurance, they spend 12.4. So they're assuming that once you put every single person on the Medicare for All plan and completely get rid of the private health insurance, you're not going to see a dramatic increase on overhead costs from 2.2%. That's how they come up with the $219 billion saving. Does that make sense to you? Does that really make sense to you? Then they say you're going to save $78 billion from avoiding what they say is unnecessary hospitalizations and emergency room visits by improving access to primary care. That is 100% speculative. And what they did not account for very much, they give, I think, like 10% increase. But when all of a sudden you offer free health care, would you then generally assume that more people are going to take advantage of the healthcare services? I think so. I think a whole lot of people, especially if the argument is a lot of people forgo going to the doctor because they can't afford it. Well, if that's the case, what about the 78% of the country that right now has health insurance? 52% of which comes from their employer. If under those circumstances, they're withholding visits to the doctor, don't you think that if you give it to them for free, they're going to go in bigger numbers? This Yale study doesn't account for that. You're listening to the Jason Rancho Show. We're waiting for the president to speak at a press conference at the White House about the coronavirus. There has been an increase in concern as to whether or not we are prepared for what everyone seems to agree will be an outbreak. The question is, how deadly is that outbreak going to be? There's a lot of bad information coming out. There's a lot of concerning lack of information coming out of China. So we're going to hear from the president and his experts this hour. You can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/Jason Rantz. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? National.
So we're one step closer to heroin injection sites in Seattle because of a court in Philadelphia decided to let a nonprofit move forward with a heroin injection site there. They believe that that thing is going to be up and running potentially as early as next week. Here in Seattle, we've heard over and over and over again from Mayor Jenny Durkin and this council that they want to move forward in some capacity with a heroin injection site. It's gone from a standalone site, perhaps in downtown Seattle, to this idea of having a mobile injection site where you're going to the people, to the homeless encampments, where people are in sort of dire need, I suppose, of clean needles. I guess that's what Seattle wants to do. And they've said, look, we're going to hold off a little bit until we realize what's going on in Philadelphia, because if they rule in favor of their plan, we have a little bit more of a leeway here to move forward without a concern that we're going to have to fight in a lengthy legal battle. So the court there decided that they can move forward. It is going to be appealed. We'll see if that actually puts an injunction on this group. They're called Safe House, which is I suppose ironic because they're only safe because they have doctors there, which actually tells you that it's not safe to shoot up heroin. In fact, it's never safe for the person who's shooting up heroin to shoot up heroin. It 100% of the time is going to do damage to your body. Yes, it is safer than doing it without medical personnel there to ensure that you're not having an overdose. That's true. They say their president, or excuse me, their vice president says, Philadelphia, like the nation, is in a crisis. And we have the opportunity to address that crisis. We owe it to Philadelphia to do just that. Their former governor, Ed Rendell, was on NBC 10 in Philadelphia, and he made the argument as to why they need this heroin injection site.
It is personal for so many people. A thousand people plus have been dying for the last 3 years in Philadelphia. Think about that. The murder rate soars over 300, and everyone goes crazy. Murder rate's out of control. 300 of our young people are dying. Well, 3.5 times that many people die of opioid overdoses.
I understand his concern. The problem is he's not actually going after the underlying cause of the death, which is the drug addiction. I know that they want to pretend that this is going to help a whole bunch of people, but it's not, because I don't know how many addicts are willing to take the bus to go down to that heroin injection site. The way that they overpromise what this is going to deliver is shocking. And they're setting it up so that they can end up expanding it. The only way that this can work in the way that they're now talking about it is if you have many, many dozens of these sites open all across Philadelphia and all across the Seattle region. Because when you think about it on a local level, if you're an addict and you live in, say, Greenwood, and the heroin injection site is in downtown Seattle, is the addict going to actually hop on a bus, go all the way down to downtown Seattle, and then shoot up there, and then just sort of chill there for a bit, and then go back to Greenwood to their encampment? Probably not. They're going to do it where they are. Now, I suppose it's possible that someone who's maybe a functioning addict, who isn't necessarily homeless, or some of the homeless people who are in the downtown Seattle area actually go to these places. But that's generally not how it works. And when you look in Vancouver, and Insight, which is the company that does heroin injection sites there, they've not had a great record. First of all, the immediate vicinity around the heroin injection site is an absolute nightmare. It's an absolute mess. It's filled with people who literally look like zombies, just hanging out, stoned out of their minds, strung out of their minds. And ironically, they're not all going into that heroin injection site. I saw a drug deal, which I'm told is not supposed to happen outside of these places, literally happen a block away from Insight. There were used needles on the sidewalks right around Insight, which that's supposed to address. You know what is the best way to prevent an overdose death? Getting the person not to shoot up heroin to begin with. And we stopped talking about treating the addiction, haven't we? We've completely stopped talking about it. When this was first proposed and we were having this national conversation here in Washington State, we were told that this is going to get people treatment for their heroin addiction. But then they started to shift the language because they didn't have the data to back up these things actually get people off of heroin. Because if you were to tell me that a heroin injection site actually gets people who are addicted treatment for their addiction, I'd probably be all in. You'd have to show me the actual data to suggest that it works. But if you're saying, you know what, we got a 34% chance of getting someone completely clean once we have some kind of contact with them at these heroin injection sites, I'm going to say, okay, you know what, maybe it is worth looking at. Maybe it is a good idea. But they didn't have that data. And so they started to shift the way they talked about it. They started to talk about it as harm reduction. They were reducing the harm that's done by people who shoot up in alleyways, in parks. And yes, it is true. When you decide to completely shift the language into, well, this is safer than doing it without a nurse around or a medical professional. Okay, fine. But you're still ignoring why we're talking about this to begin with. Isn't the goal, shouldn't the goal be to get people off of heroin because we know it's ultimately going to kill them? It may not kill them in the moment because they've got the nurse there who's making sure that they don't have an overdose, but it's going to kill them at some point. And if we're supposed to be compassionate, which is what I'm told this is all about, showing compassion for people by giving them a place to shoot up, shouldn't the conversation be what to do to get them off of the heroin? Oh, well, we're going to give them a pamphlet when they come into the heroin injection site, and it'll give them some details on the resources available to them so that they can get off this deadly drug. Really? So the dude who shows up, already strung out, shooting up, he's going to then look at the pamphlet and say, while he's high, I'd really like to turn my life around all of a sudden. Thank you. That's not going to happen. They don't like to treat these folks as victims. And that's a weird, but it's very similar to the last segment. They are victims of addiction that is going to ultimately take their life. And we seem okay just giving them a spot to shoot up with some medical professional. And maybe we'll have mood lighting. Set a nice little sound to Enya in the background. You can't have mood lighting because then they can't find veins, I guess. I just talked myself out of my own idea.
Good job. See, now you're seeing the side of the druggies.
Clearly. 1-800-465-8770. Text the keyword app, APP, to 1-800-465-8770. We'll send you a link so you can download the smartphone app on your iPhone or your Android. That way you can stream the show and the station wherever it is you are. You can get breaking news alerts, alerts about cool guests that are coming up. Speaking of cool guests coming up, later on in the show, the mayor of Ording is going to stop by so we can praise him for doing something that makes total sense, which is actually live in a world in which 976 passed and was accepted by the courts. We're going to talk about that in the next hour. Coming up next, Highway 99 causing problems, not just in the world of traffic, but in the world of policing.
Breaking news on AM 770 KTTH.
Welcome back to the Jason Rand Show. The president is about to take to the podium at the White House for a news conference with CDC officials to talk about the coronavirus. There is a lot of interest, obviously, in the United States as to whether or not the coronavirus is going to come here and in what form will it be here. We already know that we have cases of coronavirus that have been confirmed in the United States. The last number I saw was, I believe, 62 or 64. And we know that CDC officials have in the last week or so, and health officials said, it's inevitable that we're going to have some kind of coronavirus outbreak here in the United States. The question, however, is how serious is it going to be and how prepared are we for the inevitable outbreak of the coronavirus here in the United States? The president put forward a financial plan, an ask of the Senate. That Senate Democrats said wasn't too much, wasn't enough. They need more money. They need better plans. Oh, and by the way, you should give us even more money to the CDC. So it's kind of hard to get a general sense of where the United States is as far as planning is concerned when listening to, frankly, any politician, because they're going to turn this, unfortunately, into politics. I'm more curious to hear directly from the men and women with the CDC and the health officials out there. We're in that weird world where we know that the numbers coming from China are not accurate. We don't trust it. We've seen more and more people who we all kind of thought were healthy end up succumbing to the coronavirus. There were three doctors, two of whom, 29 years old, in China treating this, died. Now, is it because of their close proximity to a whole bunch of sick people and they weren't taking care of themselves? We don't know all the details yet. That's been the speculation. That's been some of the reporting. But when you're telling us that we can't necessarily trust the information coming out of China, it's going to get people wondering what's really happening there. And of course, when we think about preparedness in the United States, we ask ourselves, I'm sure there are a lot of families out there asking themselves whether or not they're ready for an outbreak. And what does being ready for an outbreak even look like? Dr. Peter Rabinowitz is the director of the UW Center for One Health Research. He was on with our sister station, Kyle Radio, on the G and Ursula Show, and said, look, right now you don't have to panic, but you should be aware and concerned.
It's certainly time to be prepared, and it's time to have some worry about it. It's not time to panic. The risk is still low, but it's definitely a possibility. Things have changed a lot in the past week.
So they say that the chances of getting it are low, but how do you contract coronavirus?
You can definitely get something like the flu, and we think coronavirus, by touching a surface that has those droplets on it and then touching your mouth or your eyes or your nose.
So it's not airborne, but if you have some sort of contact with the coronavirus on a surface, they believe that afterwards, if you end up touching your eyes or your nose, which we do all the time, people do that all the time when you're when you're paying attention and present to the amount of times you actually rub your eyes or put your hand near your mouth, it's actually kind of shocking how often that is. And if you're not someone who washes your hands frequently enough, if you're not someone who uses Purell, you end up getting the flu. And in this case, the fear is you're going to end up getting the coronavirus. And frankly, the data right now isn't looking very good.
It still is more virulent. The case mortality, the number of people it kills out of all the number it affects, is higher than the average flu.
Higher than the average flu. That's scary. That's really scary. Which is why people need to start preparing.
If we don't take some preparations right now and it gets worse, we're going to really feel like we missed the boat. We need to be concerned, we need to be worried, and we need to be doing some preparation.
Now, we've seen worldwide, how this has quickly spread. We've seen some of the numbers coming out of Italy. There have been a cluster of outbreaks there to the point where Austria the other day wasn't allowing a train with people who were suspected of being exposed to coronavirus actually come into the country. And so it's spreading in Europe. And before long, it's going to spread in a significant way here. But again, as we're waiting for the president, along with these CDC officials, to speak and walk up to the podium. Right now, we've got just all the CDC officials kind of standing around, just all like, where's the president? When is he going to come out? And they're twiddling their thumbs. One person just realized her hair was a little bit out of place, and she fixed that.
I mean, the door keeps opening. Oh,
there we go. The president is now coming out to the podium to speak on the coronavirus outbreak. Here is our live coverage of the president.
Earlier today, a wicked murderer opened fire at a Molson Coors Brewing Company plant, taking the lives of five people. A number of people were wounded, some badly wounded. Our hearts break for them and their loved ones. We send our condolences. We'll be with them. And it's a terrible thing, terrible thing. So our hearts go out to the people of Wisconsin and to the families. Thank you very much. I've just received another briefing from a great group of talented people on the virus that is going around to various parts of the world. We have, through some very good early decisions that were actually ridiculed at the beginning, we closed up our borders to flights coming in from certain areas that were hit by the coronavirus and hit pretty hard. And we did it very early. A lot of people thought we shouldn't have done it that early, and we did, and it turned out to be a very good thing. And the number one priority from our standpoint is the health and safety of the American people. And that's the way I viewed it when I made that decision. Because of all we've done, the risk to the American people remains very low. And we have the greatest experts in the world, really in the world, right here. The people that are called upon by other countries when things like this happen. We're ready to adapt, and we're ready to do whatever we have to. As the disease spreads, if it spreads, as most of you know, the level that we've had in our country is very low, and those people are getting better, or we think that in almost all cases, the better are getting. We have a total of 15. We took in some from Japan. You heard about that, because they're American citizens, and they're in quarantine. And they're getting better, too. But we felt we had an obligation to do that. It could have been as many as 42. And we found that it was just an obligation we felt that we had. We could have left them, and that would have been very bad, I think, American people. And they're recovering. Of the 15 people, the original 15, as I call them, 8 of them have returned to their homes, to stay in their homes until fully recovered. 1 is in the hospital, and 5 have fully recovered, and 1 is, we think, in pretty good shape, and it's in between hospital and going home. So we have a total of, we have a total of 15 people, and they're in a process of recovering, with some already having fully recovered. We started out by looking at certain things. We've been working with the Hill very, very carefully, very strongly. And I think we have very good bipartisan spirit for money. We were asking for $2.5 billion, and we think that's a lot. But the Democrats, and I guess Senator Schumer, wants us to have much more than that. And normally in life, I'd say, we'll take it. We'll take it. If they want to give more, we'll do more. We're going to spend whatever's appropriate. Hopefully, we're not going to have to spend so much, because we really think we've done a great job in keeping it down to a minimum. And again, we've had tremendous success beyond what people would have thought. Now, at the same time, you do have some outbreaks in some countries. Italy and various countries are having some difficulty. China, you know about where it started. I spoke with President Xi. We had a great talk. He's working very hard, I have to say. He's working very, very hard. And if you can count on the reports coming out of China, that spread has gone down quite a bit. The infection seems to have come down over the last 2 days. As opposed to getting larger, it's actually gotten smaller. In one instance where we think it's somewhat reliable, it seems to have gotten quite a bit smaller. with respect to the money that's being negotiated, they can do whatever they want. I mean, they can. We'll do the 2.5. We're requesting 2.5. Some Republicans would like us to get 4, and some Democrats would like us to get 8.5. And we'll be satisfied whatever it is. We're bringing in a specialist, very highly regarded specialist, tomorrow, who works actually at the State Department. Very, very tremendously talented in doing this. I want you to understand something that shocked me when I saw it, that I spoke with Dr. Fauci on this, and I was really amazed, and I think most people are amazed to hear it. The flu in our country kills from 25,000 people to 69,000 people a year. That was shocking to me. And so far, if you look at what we have with the 15 people, and they're recovering. One is pretty sick, but hopefully will recover. But the others are in great shape. But think of that, 25,000 to 69,000. Over the last 10 years, we've lost 360,000. These are people that have died from the flu, from what we call the flu. Hey, did you get your flu shot? And that's something. Now, what we've done is we've stopped non-U.S. citizens from coming into America from China. That was done very early on. We're screening people, and we have been at a very high level, screening people coming into the country from infected areas. We have in quarantine those infected and those at risk. We have a lot of great quarantine facilities. We're rapidly developing a vaccine, and they can speak to you. The professionals can speak to you about that. The vaccine is coming along well, and in speaking to the doctors, we think this is something that we can develop fairly rapidly, a vaccine for the future, and coordinate with the support of our partners. We have great relationships with all of the countries that we're talking about. Some, it's a fairly large number of countries. Some, it's one person. And many countries have no problem whatsoever. And we'll see
Donald
what happens.
Live,
but we're very, very ready for this, for anything, whether it's going to be a breakout of larger proportions or whether or not we're, you know, we're at that very low level. And we want to keep it that way. So we're at the low level. As they get better, we take them off the list so that we're going to be pretty soon at only 5 people. And we could be at just 1 or 2 people over the next short period of time. So we've had very good luck. The Johns Hopkins, I guess it is, a highly respected, great place. They did a study, comprehensive, the country's best and worst prepared for an epidemic. And the United States is now, we're rated number one. We're rated number one for being prepared. This is a list of different countries. I don't want to get in your way, especially since you do such a good job. This is a list of the different countries. United States is rated number one, most prepared. United Kingdom, Netherlands, Australia, Canada, Thailand, Sweden, Denmark, South Korea, Finland. This is a list of the best rated countries in the world by Johns Hopkins. We're doing something else that's important to me, because he's been terrific in many ways, but he's also very good on health care. And we really followed him very closely. A lot of states do. When Mike was governor, Mike Pence of Indiana, they've established great health care. They have a great system there, a system that a lot of the other states have really looked to and changed their systems. They wanted to base it on the Indiana system. He's very good. And I think, and he's really very expert at the field. And what I've done is I'm going to be announcing exactly right now that I'm going to be putting our Vice President Mike Pence in charge. And Mike will be working with the professionals, doctors, and everybody else that's working. The team is brilliant. I spent a lot of time with the team over the last couple of weeks, but they're totally brilliant. And we're doing really well. And Mike is going to be in charge, and Mike will report back to me. But he's got a certain talent for this, and I'm going to ask Mike Pence to say a few words, please. Thank you, Mike.
This is Vice President Mike Pence live at the White House speaking about preparedness for the coronavirus.
Thank you, Mr. President. President Trump's made clear from the first days of this administration, we have no higher priority than the safety, security, health, and well-being of the American people. And from the first word of an outbreak of the coronavirus, the president took unprecedented steps to protect the American people from the spread of this disease. He recounted those briefly, but the establishment of travel restrictions, an aggressive quarantine effort of Americans that are returning, a declaration of a public health emergency, and establishing the White House Corona Task Force are all reflective of the urgency that the president has brought to a whole-of-government approach. As a former governor from the state where the first MERS case emerged in 2014, I know full well the importance of presidential leadership, the importance of administration leadership, and the vital role of partnerships of state and local governments and health authorities in responding to the potential threat of dangerous infectious diseases. And I look forward, Mr. President, to serving in this role, bringing together all the members of the Corona Task Force that you've established, HHS, CDC, DHS, the Department of Transportation, and state. This team has been, at your direction, Mr. President, meeting every day since it was established. My role will be to continue to bring that team together, to bring to the President the best options for action to see to the safety and well-being and health of the American people. We'll also be continuing to reach out to governors, state and local officials. In fact, in the recent days, the White House met with over 40 state, county, and city health officials from over 30 states and territories to discuss how to respond to this, to the potential threat of the coronavirus. We'll be working with them in renewed ways to make sure they have the resources to be able to respond. And as the President said, we'll be adding additional personnel here at the White House to support our efforts on the President's behalf. We'll also be working with members of Congress to ensure that the resources are available for this whole of government response. And we'll be working very closely with Secretary Azar and his team that have done an outstanding job communicating to the public to ensure the American people have the best information on ways to protect themselves and their families, and also that the public has the most timely information on the potential threat to the American people. Mr. President, as we've been briefed, while the threat to the American public remains low of a spread of the coronavirus, you have directed this team to take all steps necessary to continue to ensure the health and well-being of the American people. And the people of this country can be confident that under your leadership, we will continue to bring the full resources of the federal government in coordination with our state and local partners to see to the health and well-being and to the effective response to the coronavirus here in the United States of America. With that, the President has asked me to recognize the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Alex Azar, and also the Deputy Director of CDC, Dr. Ann Schockett, for Vermont.
Secretary?
Secretary Azar is stepping up to
the podium. Thank you, Mr. Vice President, and thank you, Mr. President, for gathering your public health experts here today and for your strong leadership in keeping America safe. And I just want to say I could not be more delighted that you've asked the Vice President, my old friend and colleague, to lead this whole of government approach with us under the emergency support function number 8. As of today, we have 15 cases of COVID-19 that have been detected in the United States, with only one new case detected in the last 2 weeks. We also have 3 cases among Americans repatriated from Wuhan and 42 cases among Americans repatriated who had been stuck on the Diamond Princess in Japan. The President's early and decisive actions, including travel restrictions, have succeeded in buying us incredibly valuable time. This has helped us contain the spread of the virus, handle the cases that we have, and prepare for the possibility that we will need to mitigate broader spread of infections within the United States. The president's actions, taken with the strong support of his scientific advisors, have proven to be appropriate, wise, and well-calibrated to the situation. We're grateful for the hard work that healthcare workers, first responders, communities, and state and local leaders have put into the response so far. Because of this hard work and the president's leadership, the immediate risk to the American public has been and continues to be low. Our containment strategy has been working. At the same time, what every one of our experts and leaders have been saying for more than a month now remains true. The degree of risk has the potential to change quickly, and we can expect to see more cases in the United States. That is why we've been reminding the American public and our state, local, and private sector partners that they should be aware of what a broader response would look like. CDC has recommended that the American public and especially state and local governments, businesses, and other organizations should refresh themselves on how they would respond in the event that the situation worsens. We're encouraging Americans to learn what future steps might be necessary to keep themselves and their communities safe. Knowing these potential steps now can help keep the risk to you and your community low. Americans can find useful information at cdc.gov/COVID-19. And we're working closely with government and private sector partners to educate them about preparedness. Finally, we've begun working with Congress to secure the funding that we need. There are five major priorities in the White House request to Congress that the White House made on Monday. These priorities are, first, expanding our surveillance network. Second, support for state and local governments' work. Third and fourth, development of therapeutics and vaccines. And fifth, manufacturing and purchase of personal protective equipment like gowns and masks.
That is Secretary Alex Azar of Health and Human Services. We've just been covering live the press conference from the president, flanked by the vice president and CDC officials, along with Secretary Azar, delivering in a rather calm tone, assuring the nation that we're very prepared, in his words, for the coronavirus if it spreads. He said the number one priority is health and safety of the American people. He reminded us that the risk to the American people remains very low. They went through a whole host of things that they had done, including closing up the borders for flights from some spots that were hit with the coronavirus. Mike Pence has been named the person in charge of coordinating the efforts on the coronavirus. We're going to continue our coverage when we return right here on the Jason Rant Show.